barrier, we've pushed all the right buttons. The problem is we can't connect. Has to be actual. A guy reminded me at the break of a story I used to tell, and I haven't told it in a while, but this whole thing about God's grace was so confusing to me. And then I saw, in my first couple years of sobriety, I saw a movie on TV. It was an old World War II movie, and it was about Truck Lagoon, actually. And it was about this, in the South Pacific during World War II, there were so many thousands of islands in the South Pacific that the U.S. did not have the manpower to station troops on all of them. So what they did is they would often strategically parachute in an observer to set up a base camp to watch for Japanese troop movements and shipping and fleet, etc. And they'd have a network of communication across the South Pacific. And this particular movie was about a guy who parachuted into this atoll, and he landed there. And on landing, evidently, something got jostled around with the radio, and when he started unpacking his gear, he tried to contact the fleet, and he couldn't get them. And he fooled with the radio a bit, and he went about the business of exploring the island and setting his base camp. And as the days passed, he would try every day a little bit to just see if he could get the fleet, and there was nothing. And one day he's coming over a sand dune, and he goes out and he sees in the lagoon that the whole Japanese fleet is coming into the lagoon. And he's panics, and he runs back to his base camp, and he gets the radio, and he's shaking it, and he's trying, he's got to get the fleet. He's got to get them, and he can't get them. And he remembers it. But wait a minute, there was a manual. We packed a manual with this. And he digs in the bottom of this duffel bag, and he pulls out this manual. And he opens the manual, and he starts to read it. And it's talking about certain symptomologies and static and things, effects in the equipment. And it asks him to make a couple little tests. And he does, and it starts following the directions, and it walks him through the process of repairing the radio. And he found out that what it was one of the tubes wasn't seated right. It had become unseated, and he reseated the tube, rebooted the radio, and there's the fleet. And the fleet wasn't holding its message or its connection with him because he was a bad guy, or he had a bad, he had a broken receiver. And that's what happens to us, is that where other people seem to easily access God's grace and maintain it, as my daughter is one of the, she's just a naturally spiritually connected person. Her internal compass, her God consciousness and sense of God's direction in her life is almost infallible. She would just never think of doing things that seem like a good idea to me. Right? You know what I'm saying? She just had an aversion to that. Oh, Dad, you wouldn't want to do that? That's not right. Well, yeah, okay, it's not right, but it might be fun. You know, I mean, see, she doesn't go down that road. Self doesn't clamor in her to the extremes that it does and blocks her from the God within her. That most people live with, and they're not even aware that that's God. That's just their internal compass. It's just so right on for them. But people like me, we argue with that because of the clamoring for self-gratification and self-grandizement. Self is so strong in me, it blocks out the signal from God that is deep within me. And that is where I think that we possibly, those of us who suffer from alcoholism, whether it's from being around it or actually having it, are handicapped and become spiritually sick. We fill up with ourselves to a degree that normal people don't. My daughter, she is not an extreme example of self-willed runner-up. She's human. She has anxieties from time to time. She has worries, and she gets her feelings hurt, etc., etc. But she's not extreme. An example: about a year ago, she ended this relationship that she was in, and it was kind of hard on her, you know. And I'm her dad; I love her, and I went to have dinner with her that night, and telling me about it, and I'm trying to console her and say daddy-like things that I don't know what I'm doing, you know. I'm just like, you have to kiss a lot of frogs before you meet your prince. I don't know what I'm saying. You know, I'm just trying. I just love her, you know. I'm just trying to, I want her to feel better. And so I go home that night. I come back about a week later, and I'm excited to see her because I know she's going through a tough time. And I'm meeting her in this restaurant. I slide into the booth. I said, "Kate, how you doing?" She says, "Oh, good, Dad." I said, "You know, with the breakup thing, you know, with the relationship breakup." She says, "Oh, Dad, it's fine. You can't wallow around in that stuff. I've already moved on. I'm actually going out with the guy next week. And, you know, you just have to move on." At her, and I said to her, I said, "Kate, you couldn't have possibly got enough mileage out of that yet." See, I'd have made my sponsor's eyes glaze over for a month. I'd have captured a meeting on it for, you know, I'd have milked it for every ounce of drama there was. I'll drink of that stuff like I drank whiskey. I am not a social feeler. My daughter, she just feels it and goes on. She's not an extreme example of self-will run riot. And she's not blocked from God the way I am. And all the spiritual reading in the world, as a friend of mine who's a Catholic priest who taught theology for the College of Cardinals in the Vatican, and he said he had more information than probably anybody on the planet about God, and yet he was lost from God because he was so full of himself. There was too much of him between him and God. And that's the problem. When we make a decision in step three to turn first our will, which is our wants, our way, our perception, our judgments, our opinions, we're abandoning that first. And I think that's the most important thing. I've often thought to myself, I think if you could really 100% surrender your will to God's and not have a way, you could keep your life and you could manage your life because you wouldn't have an opinion about any of it. You just go with the flow. It's the will that is the wrench in the machine. It's the will is the aspect of me that plays God and pushes God out of the way as I clamor for what I want. So you can say the third step prayer. You can have full and absolute honest intention to turn your will and your life over to the care of God and still be unable to do it in actuality, in your daily living and in your feet and your actions. Until I start to dismantle the will, dismantle the judgment machine of the ego. I went to an attorney one time and I was making a trust, and it was a trust and a last will, and he said to me something I never forgot. He said, "You know what you're doing here, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah, I'm making my will." He said, "Well," he said, "aren't you, isn't this in effect your last judgment? Your will is your judgment. You're judging these people to be cool. You're going to give them property and money and stuff. You're judging these people to be idiots. They get nothing. It's your last judgment. And I'm turning my way, my judgments, my opinions, I'm abandoning them to God and not having a way." Well, I can't do that until I dismantle the judgment machine. And the AA, this is where AA is brilliant, and I think rises as far as a spiritually effectiveness for people full of themselves like we are. AA is, this is perfect. Because what do? Well, the first thing we do in this inventory process is they trick you. They want you to list all the wrong people. All the people that, if there was any justice in the world, would owe you and probably the universe an amends. You're going to put down all the stupid people. All the people that have done it wrong. All the people you feel smugly superior to. You're going to put, when they're tricking you, they're saying, let's put down all your judgments and so we can look at them on paper. Let's see what your ego does. Let's see how you play God. Let's put down all your judgments. And then it walks me through six things that the book asks me to do to dismantle this judgment machine. And the first thing we do is we list the people, institutions, or principles with whom we're angry. That's, if you want to look on page 65, that's the first column on the left. I'm resentful at Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones. I thought a great idea for a t-shirt would be kill Brown, screw Mrs. Jones, punch the employer, divorce the wife, and then at the bottom it says, are these extravagant promises? No, that would be a t-shirt I might buy. Well, the first thing, so I make the list. And the guys, I know guys I sponsor, resistant to, we want to minimize this stuff. Because the ego is very clever. The ego read ahead and knows amends are coming. So we want to minimize this stuff, you know. We don't want to, you know, it's just, oh, that doesn't bother me. What happens when you see them? Oh, I plot their death. But they don't bother me. I don't know. Yeah. Anyone you ever have a conversation with in your head should be on here. Anyone that you think is stupid should be on here. All the idiots should be on here. All the people that do it wrong should be on here. So the first thing is I make the list of the people, institutions, principles, mostly people in my experience. Few institutions pop in there. Church sometimes. IRS frequently gets on there. I don't know why, they just get on there. Police sometimes, but for the most part, it's people, individuals. Because we have, in the 12 steps and 12 traditions, it said in the book, in step four, it says it is from our twisted relationships that we have suffered the most. And so we list these people. The first column is who. Then it says we ask ourselves why. Why we were angry. And that's the cause, called the second middle column. And if you'll notice, it's bullet points. Very important. Just little brief bullet points. I don't like bullet points. I think these should be essays. I want to write it out to the point that when I read it to my sponsor, he gets it. Yes, that's why bullet points are hardly enough for this. You want to write it out to the point where he hears it and he goes, he did that to you? I'm getting the boys together. We're going to go over there in the middle of the night. We're going to make this. You know, that's the way I want to explain it. Because if you, anything more than bullet points, what do? We fall into the justification again. Self-justification. The problem with self-justification is self. Right? So, bullet points. Just to the point. Bullet points, just the facts. The third thing we do is I'm looking at the aspects of self that have been, the book uses five terms. Top of page 65, it says that we're hurt or threatened. Then it says our injuries are injured, are interfered with, or affected. So I'm looking for the aspects of self. My sex relations, my self-esteem, my security, my personal relationships, my pride, my ambitions, my pocketbook, that have been hurt, threatened, affected, injured, or interfered with. And then when I get those first three columns, this is not the end. This is the beginning. This is the documentation of my victimization on paper that I must dismantle. It starts by, we consider, the book says we consider these three columns carefully. And it walks me through a shift in and a change of mind. It walks me through a whole page on page 66 where it keeps telling me over and over again how this stuff's killing me. It's cutting me off from the sunlight of the spirit. It's poison. These are infinitely grave. They're deadly. They're killing me. To sell me the idea that there is no reason to hang on to this. All to bring me to a line, the second line in the last full paragraph, where it says, if you've bought everything that's said above this, then this should be true, that we are prepared to look at these from an entirely different angle. Well, we've been looking at them through our perception, which is very self-centered and self-serving. An entirely different angle would be to look at it through their eyes. An entirely different angle would be to say to yourself, well, what am I doing here in these first three columns? Okay, I got column number one. I'm like the prosecuting attorney. I got the perpetrator. Column number two, I got the heinous acts, the bullet points. Column number three, I got the damage done. I've got my cases built. I'm ready to go to court to prosecute these guys. Well, now they're stopping me. They say, well, there's going to be a change of venue here. You are now the defense attorney. What? No, you're going to go over there and you're going to plead their case from their point of view. Well, there won't be any justice on that side. Yeah, well, let's see. Let's look at it through their eyes. What does it look like to them? I'll tell you one thing I know for sure. I don't know what your worst resentments are, but I'll bet you anything that if the person you hated and the case you built against them, if that person were to hit a bottom and end up in a 12-step program and they were doing a resentment and they put your name on the list and were talking to their sponsor as honestly and as genuinely as they could about what happened between you and them, I bet you their story will be different from yours. Now the ego, the minute you think that, the ego goes, yeah, but my story's right. what's your track record with right? Perception is an elusive, funny thing. Police realize when they interview witnesses how fragile perception is. If you've ever had this experience that I had with my sister and I grew up in the same household, same parents, same time frame, everything. When we sit down to talk about our childhood, the things that happened in that house, you'd think we lived in two different houses. And her perception of that was completely different from mine. But she doesn't look at it with the mind of an alcoholic that's looking for problems. My sister felt the love in our household. I was so self-involved that I could see it and appreciate it intellectually, but I couldn't feel it because I was that internally focused and disconnected even as a kid. I knew it was there. There was no doubt. I knew my parents loved me, but I couldn't feel it. I was that disconnected already because I was so much into myself already. My mother used to tell me that when I was a kid. I didn't understand until I was sober a couple of years. I remember what she used to say. She used to say, Rob, you're full of yourself. I didn't know what that meant. She told me one time, you think you're the center of the universe. And I went, well, yes, I am, Mama. I mean, everything revolved around me. I was the center of the universe. So, we're prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle. And the book says we to see that this world and its people really dominated us. In this state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. When I was my first year or so sobriety, there was a guy in AA named Billy Taylor, and Billy was a pretty good member of AA, and I found myself in a coffee shop with him several times after meetings. We used to sit there and just talk about AA, and Billy was an easy guy to talk to. And one night, because he was an easy guy to talk to, it was just him and I opened up to him about a couple of those want-to-take-to-the-grave things that I was really ashamed of. You know, those deep, dark secrets that, oh, God, you just think about them and they haunt you. We all have stuff like that. Everyone, I've heard 200 to 300 fifth steps. Every alcoholic I've ever talked to has something like that. It might be that you in a drunken rage, you beat your kids and it haunts you. Or maybe you stole from somebody and let somebody else take the blame, or you dimed somebody out to the cops, or you had sex with someone you wouldn't even want anybody to know you'd have lunch with. You know what I mean? You just, and I had my stuff that I was really ashamed of, and I told Billy about it. And Billy took it okay. He didn't say me too. It would have helped if he would have said me too. He didn't say me too. He said, well, I'm sure you're not the only one that's ever done that, and someday that'll help people. You know, AA party line kind of stuff. But I didn't really think much of it. And I went home that night, and then right after that, I got my shift changed, and I was no longer working 8 to 4. I was working 4 to midnight. And I went for a long period of time, and I didn't see him because I'm going to different meetings. And one night, I was working 6 days a week at that time, and one night on my night off, I went to a meeting I normally don't go to, and the meeting's a couple minutes off from starting, and I walk into the room, and I saw Billy across the room, and I was delighted. I hadn't seen him in a while. I was delighted to see him, and I say, hey, Billy, how you doing? And he looks at me with this pained look on his face and just turns away and walks away and sits down, and I sit down, and the meeting starts, and I am nuts. Because I know what just happened here. That guy's judging me for that crap. I knew I shouldn't have told him that. I knew it. And I'll tell you, there's a part of me doesn't blame him, because God knows I always suspected if you knew about me what I knew about me, you'd feel about me the way I feel about me, and that's not good. And I sit there, but I don't get hurt and stay hurt. I get hurt and get mad. It's a natural knee-jerk reaction with me that I get angry, and I'm sitting there and I'm starting to feel that phony, rotten SOB, all that AA pap, that's just a bunch of crap. He's judging me for that stuff. I'm getting angrier and angrier. And then I had this awakening. I thought, oh, wait a minute. Oh my God. The reason he can't even look me in the eye, that SOB has been telling people that stuff. And it became so clear to me. I had just asked a girl out that was friends with him, and she wouldn't go out with me. I knew he told her that sleazy stuff about me. And there's a running partner of his that had been a little distant. I knew he'd been telling that guy. And now I am going to kill him. And feel justified. Because I don't just get resentments that are personal. My resentments are global. I mean, this is for the, if he's doing that to me, he's probably doing it to other people in AA. I mean, they're going to make a statue of me at GSO if I straighten this guy out. You know, this is for the good of AA. Right? I'm cocked and ready, man. As soon as this meeting's over, man, I'm just taking it off. I'm cutting into him. He's going to deserve everything he gets. And the meeting's about over, and the chairman says, anybody have a burning desire? And Billy raises his hand and tells everybody in the room that the biopsy came back and it was malignant stage 4, and he had a very short time to live, and he was scared. And I sat there, and it was like somebody threw a bucket of cold water on me as I sank down into my chair, and I thought, oh my God. I thought it was about me. The pained look I saw on his face wasn't about me. And the day he found out he was dying, He was probably so scared and up in his head freaking out that he didn't even see me. And it was like a postcard card from God. Dear Bob, you don't know shit. Love God. Very important. Because when I got into the fourth step, I knew something. I knew that my perception is easily wrong. See, if you're so egocentric that you can't be wrong, you can't change. You'll never change. You'll never get free. A big piece of what we do here is to surrender and be wrong. Egocentric, control freak people can't be wrong. They'd rather die than be wrong. They'd rather be miserable and unhappy and lose night's sleeps than be wrong. That's how ego dominant they are. And I was lucky. I had suffered enough from myself in my sobriety that by the time I was 4 years sober and I was doing this, I was prepared to look at these from an entirely different angle. I was willing to consider the possibility that all my perceptions of these people might be wrong. It might be wrong. And the book walks you through that because it says that we can't wish these away any more than alcohol. So what do? It says, this was our course. And I think this is the transformational part of the fourth step, right here. More than anything else. It's all transformational. But this part changed my life so dramatically, I've never been the same since. And what's it asking me to do? It's asking me to make a realization. Now, this is to connect the dots inside me and make some stuff real. And that's not placated intellectually, but really to get some stuff here. And get what? Well, it's two parts. The first part's easy. Ego kind of likes the first part. It says we must realize that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Yeah, they are, right? Where's Dr. Kevorkian now that they're needed? Let's put them out of their misery. Yeah, they're sick and they're stupid too. Well, if that was all that it said, then nothing would change. But here's where, now that it's got me to concede that they're spiritually sick, now it's going to take me somewhere. And says, though we did not like their symptoms. What symptoms? Column number two, the bullet points. Would they have done the things they did in column number two if they'd been right with themselves and right with God? If their spirit was intact and full of love and right, would they have done what they did? I guess not. The things that are objectionable are the symptoms of the spiritual sickness. I don't know about you guys, but I heard a lot of people in my drinking days and in parts of my sobriety, but I swear to God, there was not one person on my immense list that I ever set out to intentionally and maliciously harm. Yet I harmed them just the same. And sometimes it was, emotionally, it was brutal. And I did it living because I was spiritually sick and I was full of myself and I was driven by selfishness and self-centered fear and frustration and hurt, because hurt people will hurt people. Reactionary. So, even though I didn't like their symptoms, column number two, and the way these disturbed me, column number three, pocketbook, pride, self-esteem, relationships. And then here's the kicker. Even though I didn't like the symptoms, I didn't like the way these disturbed me, that I had to realize that this person was perhaps like me, spiritually sick. Like me. You mean I have to get off my high horse, come down off the throne of judgment, and get honest and humble and genuine enough with myself to see that everything that was in them driving them has been in me and has driven me. That all the fears and hurt that drove them to be sick enough to do what they did in column number two is in me and at times has driven me to make the same kind of mistakes that they made. And then it's like all of a sudden the veil starts to lift and I'm starting to really see it now. I'm starting to see the truth. I'm starting to see it through their side of the street. That this person that I want to kill, that I've judged and I've had conversations with in my head for years trying to be vengeful and get even, I want to punish someone that's just like me. That's me. It might be me on a really bad day. It might be me with a worse childhood. It might be me in a little more pain or fear, but it's me. Can I get that? Can I get humble enough to really see that if everything was going on within me, that was going on within them, that I could have easily done to someone else what they had done to me, and maybe if I look through my past, maybe I have. Maybe I've been the guy I've judged them for so harshly for being. Maybe I've been that guy. And all of a sudden, the people that I've hated so much for so long and been so separate from and had these cases built, I'm so right about them. It's like I'm not so right about them anymore. I'm starting to understand them. The book says later that we are to grow in understanding, and this is where I think it begins, and effectiveness. I'm starting to get it. I'm starting to see the me that is in you and the you that is in me. And all of a sudden, all this separation between me and you that is created by my ego's playing God and judging you is starting to melt away a little bit. I'm starting to see the truth. I'm starting to wake up to the truth. That you could no more help being as bad as you were when you were as bad as you were as I could help being as bad as I was when I was as bad as I was. That we're kind of alike here. Sometimes, with some of my resentments, I started to have something I never, ever had before. And it was astounding to me that I could have these feelings towards an enemy. But I started to have some level of compassion for these people. Compassion comes from Latin. It's cum, meaning with, and passio, pain. It means that I'm starting to be able to sit with their pain. Like, I get you. I really see you. I'm not just seeing the irritating symptoms of your sickness. I get you. Because you're me. You're me. I get you. And all of a sudden, the separation between that me and that person starts to melt away somewhat. Now, it won't go completely away until I make the amends. Amends? To them? A tricky end of this. Is it we all discover how wrong we had been about the people we judged so harshly, and that to step up and take the responsibility for the separation between me and them and to start to mend it. And then the fifth thing we do is prayer. We write the first three columns, make the realization in our innermost self, and say the prayer. The prayer is, like all good prayers, a call for action. Willingness without action is fantasy. And so I'm saying to God, please help me to show them, to act towards them, to demonstrate towards them, to show them the same pity, patience, and tolerance I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. If the veil has been lifted, if you've woke up to the truth about this person and see yourself in them, then this is a good prayer. Because most of the people we hate at one time we loved, if they hadn't have done what they did in column number two, we probably would have been, they might have been one of our best friends. And what they did in column number two, they could no more help it than I could help doing what I did to hurt some people when I hurt people. And I start to have a little different perspective of these people and my perception starts shifting. It's funny, you know, my first two, four steps, if you would ask me after the fifth step, what was your wrongs? I'd have told you about the money I stole. I'd have told you about some of the secret sex stuff I was ashamed of. I'd have told you about things like that. If you'd asked me after I did the one in the book, I would have told you how wrong I'd been about my mother and father. How wrong I'd been about my sister. How wrong I'd been about some of the women that had loved me. How wrong I'd been about the employers that fired me. Because now I'm seeing it through their eyes, and I get it. I get it. I get it. I'm not a victim. I made decisions based on self, which we find out later we did. We made those decisions based on self. They put us in those decisions, selfish decisions, put me in that position to be hurt. I'm the guy. I'm the perpetrator. And then the last thing, the sixth thing, and this is brilliant. Wilson, there's no wiggle room here. Because he starts out this middle paragraph on 67 by saying, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. And then he repeats it again later on in the paragraph. Anytime Wilson says something twice in different words, he really is very serious about this. And he says it again when he says, We try to disregard the other person involved entirely. This is not about looking for your part. That is just a bad perception. Because when you think about it, okay, you're going to look for your part. Okay, here's my part. Well, there's an implication in that approach. And the implication is that I'm still reserving the right to think that they had a part. There's no parts here. There's my mistakes, period. And see, I think that most of us are masters at focusing on what you did wrong and then hiding my own selfish stuff in the shadow of your wrongdoings. It's a natural knee-jerk self-justifying mechanism in the alcoholic ego, is that I will hide my stuff behind your stuff. I bet you there's people. I'm probably not the only person in this room that worked somewhere and found something wrong with the boss. Maybe you saw him take merchandise home and it gave you license to steal. Or maybe you were in a relationship and you broke up with someone for a month and got back together. And when you were broke up, they went and slept with someone. So that gave you three get some free tickets. Right? Right? And you justify your own selfishness and self-gratification and blame and somehow make it their fault. But if you wouldn't have, right? And so the book's saying, stop it. Stop. Stop. Let's look. What if you had the perfect mother and father? What if you took the cases off the table of all the things you've kept score with? What if they were divinely crafted by God to be your perfect parents? And you can't blame them for nothing. Now, with them, where had you been selfish? Well, if they wouldn't have... No. Where had you been selfish? What if they were perfect? Where had you been selfish? Where had you been dishonest? Where had you been self-seeking? Where had you been frightened? And all of a sudden, the clarity of my mistakes brightens. See, I'm not dulling the waters with what you did. I'm seeing dead on. I think for some of us, this is the first time in we ever stand up and be an adult and take the responsibility for what we've done. And we're not hiding anymore behind what you did. We're owning it. Tough stuff. I was doing a fifth step with a guy, and we're in the middle of it. We're talking about this. You got to stop looking at what they did wrong. And the guy, and it was like this veil lifted, and the guy freaked out because all of a sudden in his mind, he saw his eight-step list double. I mean, double. It was like, and he just bolted. I never saw it. I just got heard from him recently. He went out again. He couldn't face it. He couldn't be that wrong. He wouldn't do it. Freedom is from being wrong. I'll give you a quick example, and then I'll turn it over to Valerie. God, I got a couple of them. I'll do my own, rather than my sponsees. I like talking about his better. I was in my 11th year of sobriety. I was married to a woman I had met in AA. We'd been together 6 years. We had a 2-year-old daughter, almost two, who I just was absolutely in love with. And I'm working. I'm building this business. I have an opportunity to build and own this company that would set me in good stead financially for the rest of my life. And it was a great opportunity, but I had to work. I had to work sometimes 8 in the morning to midnight. I'd take an hour and a half off for lunch and go to a meeting. I worked a lot. I worked 6 days a week, and it was consuming. And then I had my AA commitments and my sponsees, and we never fought, my wife and I, never once. But there was an unrealized distance between us, and I never thought anything of it because all my vacancies are full. I mean, I my life is full from work and AA. Man, I don't have no complaints. But I'm married to someone who doesn't have AA like I have AA and doesn't work. And her whole life revolves around a marriage to a guy who's gone a lot. Right? And I don't even know there's a problem. Here's my self-centeredness. If I'm fine, the world should be fine. Just get over it, Bucky. I mean, things are good here. That's how self-centered and selfish I am. I never even wondered if she was okay. And she never could tell me. And one day she comes to me in tears and she wants a divorce. I was shocked. Now that, the fact that I was shocked is symptomatic of how asleep I am in my own life. That I was shocked. Startled. I talked her out, but I said, well, come on, let's try to work this out. We'll get a counselor. We'll go to marriage counseling, which I found out later through my sponsor, who's been around forever, that marriage counseling is the kiss of death for most relationships. But I didn't know that at the time. And we went to marriage counseling. And my sponsor, my first sponsor, has retired, and he bought a big bus. And he doesn't have a cell phone. He's touring the country with his wife. So I go a week, 2 weeks sometimes before I hear him. He's got to call me from a payphone somewhere. And so I'm going through this counseling and everything, and it's tough. And so I got a guy I sponsor, Craig, who's one of my favorite sponsees, and him and I are pretty close. And I'm using him as my confidant about all the things that are happening in the counseling and the problems and my discouragement with how this thing isn't going well, and et cetera, et cetera. Well, my wife comes to me one day, and she says, I don't want to go to the counseling anymore. I really want a divorce. So I said, okay, and we live in Las Vegas, so in Las Vegas, you can get a divorce quick. I mean, quick. I mean, it's a quick state for divorces. It's so quick that you're single 3 weeks and you haven't even got the visa bill for the divorce card. That's how fast it is. And we got divorced on a Thursday afternoon. The papers are final. The next morning, Friday, I discover from friends of mine that she and my daughter moved in with my confidant, Craig, my best friend. And that they had been sleeping together the last year of my marriage. And it seemed to me like everybody knew about it except me. No, I'm over 11 years sober, and you guys have been telling me for 11 years there's no such thing as a justifiable resentment.
Hey, I got one.
This is the real thing here. And it doesn't matter if it seems justifiable. It'll kill you just the same. And it started making me sick. But God takes care of fools and idiots. I knew the answer was in the fourth step. I'd taken too many guys through this and watched them get free. And I'd gotten free earlier in my sobriety. And I knew the freedom was in there. But between the time of the divorce and me finding out about the affair and the time I did the fourth step, God was very kind to me. He threw waves of guys in my life to sponsor various lengths of sobriety that were all going through relationship breakups and divorces. I'd pile four or five of them in my car. We'd just go from meeting to meeting. We'd be like the depressed section of the meeting. You know? I remember being at the SOS club and listening to the chairman say the secretary say to the chairman of the meeting, "Don't call on those guys. Get into relationship stuff." It bought me islands in my day where I'd be so distracted by their pain and their problems that I would be off of mine for a little bit until I could eventually do this. And when I did this, column number one, I put down both their names. And column number two, the bullet points, the infidelity, the lies, the cheating, all that stuff. Column number three, what was hurt, threatened, affected, injured, interfered with everything. Pride was devastated. Pocketbook. Security. Sex. Ambitions. Everything. Every deal. And then I had to go through the process of looking at this from an entirely different angle. When I looked at it through Karen's eyes, I'll tell you, I didn't like what I saw. I hide my selfishness behind pseudo-nobility. And when I looked at it through her eyes, what I saw was a woman who wasn't involved in AA. It turned out later she wasn't even an alcoholic, even though I met her in AA. She didn't have the interest in AA. She didn't sponsor anybody. She went to a meeting with me occasionally. It didn't fill the empty places in her life. And she didn't work, so she didn't have a career. She didn't have any of that. And she's married to a guy, and he's just gone a lot. He's never home. And when he does come home late at night, at midnight, he's so tired because he's got to be back at work by 8 in the morning. He just crashes out. And when I was really able to stand in her place, I started to get the sense of her loneliness and the desolation she must have felt in that marriage. And because of her childhood, she was an adult child of an alcoholic. She was wired in such a way she couldn't have confrontation. She couldn't tell me. She was passive aggressive by nature. And she couldn't even tell me that she was unhappy. And when the best friend who's always around, when her loneliness got great enough and her resentment towards me got great enough, I started to understand. I could get it. I could see myself with all of those emotions doing exactly what she did. And then I saw the greater truth. I got it. I got what the price she paid, because it would be the same price I would pay if I'd have cheated on her. I got it. And I understood. Matter of fact, it became so clear to me, I realized that on the day of our wedding, if I would have brought into a room the greatest minds in psychology and sociology from the greatest universities in the world, and I would have given them an in-depth psychological profile and dossier on Karen, and I would have tasked these brilliant men with giving me a game plan that I could implement over the next 2 years that would make this basically loyal and principled woman cheat on her husband. Man, can you give me a plan? I'm telling you, they couldn't have given me a plan that would have been more effective than what I did over the next couple years. And the sad part is I don't even know I'm doing it. I am that asleep in my life. I am that much wrapped up in me and my business and my AA and my feelings and how I'm doing and me. I never even got it. What was going on with her at all? An awake person would have gotten it. If things are happening in your life that are shocking you, you're asleep. You're asleep. And none of us like to be waked up. It's like having somebody throw a bucket of water on you. Most of us get a little grumpy when you start waking us up. And I was asleep in my own life. I remember when I made amends to her. I don't remember the exact words I said, but I tried to tell her how sorry I was for being so selfish and wrapped up in me that I never understood how lonely she felt. And then I told her that I knew that it was really against her principles to do what she did, and I was sorry I was so absent in that marriage that her loneliness drove her to that. That I knew she normally would never have done that. And there was a point in the conversation where she started to cry. And she started to cry because all she ever wanted me to do was get it. You know, she just wanted me to get it. I never got it. And she couldn't tell me. And we became pretty good friends over the years. She's not in AA anymore. As a matter of fact, she's not an alcoholic. She's going to Haiti. She's a minister in a church. And I always figured in my small way, I drove her to the Lord. My second wife ended up in prison, so there is balance in the universe. So. That's a true story. My sponsor says, you're a carrier of something. We're not sure what yet. And then I put him down. I put his name down. He was easier, actually. Even though he was my best friend, I put him down, and I know what happened. I'm a guy. When she opened the door sexually for him, I mean, he hadn't been with anybody in so long. He was like the Alpo dog that in a commercial that they don't feed for 3 days. I mean, I get it. I understand what happened to him. He caved. I mean, If guys learn anything as they start to awaken, you learn not to put yourself in a situation where you're capable of doing something you're not going to like yourself for later. I mean, I remember he said to me one time, he was so lonely, he said, you know, gee, Bob, if I could just someday have what you have with Karen. I didn't know he meant specifically. I thought he meant in a general kind of way, you know. And I went and I made amends to him. It shocked him. He was looking at me from the corner of his eye for a while like I was going to pull a knife. He didn't know what I was up to. Why am I being nice to him? But I loved him. When the resentment is put to rest, the restoration of, I loved him before it happened. Why wouldn't I go back to that? Right? When the resentment is really put to rest, the restoration of love is automatic. And they're both in my life. Karen, not so much. She's on her way to Haiti, which I think she's crazy to go down there. But that's her deal. She's a good lady. And I sponsor him. I've sponsored him for a long time. I will see him Monday night. He just had back surgery. I got all my sponsees, most of them, to go take him a meeting Thursday night because I was on my way down here. I would have been there if I was home. And he calls me most every day. And he's a good member of AA. That almost killed him, what he did. Almost killed him. And he's a good guy. I'll see him at my house Tuesday night. Comes up to the book study up there. And I loved it. I loved him before it happened. And if you make the amends, if you're not restored back to that, then you're still ego dominant and entrenched in the judgment. You're not free. We're not looking to stuff. This is not an exercise in stuffing stuff. This is an exercise in freedom. Craig and I, we were in Arkansas. There's a big conference down there called Springtime in the Ozarks. And we did a book study down there. And I had a lot of fun with this because I am doing exactly what I'm doing here. I'm talking about the guy who was my sponsee who was sleeping with my wife. And I'm watching the audience, and there's a couple of people. They don't know who this guy is, but they're getting pissed at him. And they're like this, you know? And there's this one woman, she's sitting in the front row, and she could really tell as she's listening. She's getting this. She looks like she's chewing on a lemon. Bitter. And then I said, oh, and now it's my time's up, and it's time to hear from the guy I was just talking about. He's Craig. And she goes like this, and Craig goes, gotcha. I love that. Valerie.
That was great. For me, when I had to go write this inventory, well, I'll say this. You know, at the beginning of How It Works, it talks about grasping and developing rigorous honesty. And, I think a lot of people will say, or we say when we knew, I don't know, am I one of those people that's just naturally incapable of grasping it? I think I might be. And maybe we are, hell, I don't know. But I know I'm willing to start to become honest. The people that can't or refuse to, because I've certainly had periods where I have refused to be honest, or I'm going to edit the truth, manage the truth, or whatever. But it's telling me here that I have to begin to grasp it and then develop it, that I'm not rigorous honesty. So I got to get the gist of what rigorous honesty is, and then I got to be willing to develop that, become willing to start telling the truth. And if I can't, I'm probably not going to make it here. And I'm a natural liar. I mean, you know, many times I've heard that, you know, if your lips are moving, you're lying. I relate to that. That's me. And it also talks about if I can, and this is huge, if I can grasp and develop rigorous honesty, then I'm going to recover from grave emotional and mental disorders. Grave. I mean, grave is deadly. Emotional and mental disorders like my depression, my suicidal ideology, my anxiety, my panic disorder. I mean, you know, we're not a well lot when we get here. AA is not a hotbed of emotional and mental well-being, you know what I'm saying? But it's telling me that I can recover if I'm willing to be honest. And I was reminded of that when I started to write inventory. I was very afraid to tell the whole truth. And I'll tell you this, most people that I have, well, I won't even say most, all people that I have spoken to that went back out and drank again, there was some kind of major dishonesty, willful dishonesty in their life, without exception, over a period of time, that they refused to get honest about. So, when I had to write inventory the first time, I absolutely wanted to edit the truth. And I wanted to manage my inventory. I wanted to manage what I told my sponsor. A, I wanted my sponsor on my side, because I like to gather allies and circle the wagons when I feel hurt, threatened, wronged, or interfered with. I wanted to build my case, like Bob was talking about. It was horrifying to me when I was told I had to get down to the core resentment in 8 words or less. I'm like, but I have a story to tell you. And you'll see when I'm done that I really am right. And they are more wrong than I am. And I deserve restitution. One of the things that, you know, I saw with my inventory is that part of the reason I had gotten so sick in recovery is that there were things I was never, ever going to tell another human being, ever. And there were amends that I was never, ever going to make. As a matter of fact, they owed me. And this inventory is that leveling process of that lie for me. So when I had to go write inventory and when I got to my first couple of inventories, I'll just tell you, I managed the truth. It took a little while for me to become entirely willing to be entirely honest and not withhold anything or edit anything on my inventory. Eventually, because those resentments kept returning. That's what happened. I never fully got free because I kept editing and managing the truth about me and where I was wrong. So I never got free of them. One of the things that meant a lot to me, and I could see in my experience with my inventory and with people, and I see it with people that I sponsor today, and myself, is if I am, and Bob talked about, if I'm continually rehashing something in my mind about another individual, I am this piece on 66. They are continuing to harm me. I am staying sore. Now, there are times that I enjoy that. I get a perverse satisfaction out of that. I kind of enjoy my pain, as twisted as that is. I like being the wronged party and how I've just been harmed. And it absolutely feeds that self-obsession that, you know, I talked earlier about that low, low, low. I love it. It's twisted. It's crazy. But I do. I remember my sponsor one time, I was talking about my mind and how it would just go on and on, and I'd start thinking about negative thoughts and it'd start to generate these really powerful bad emotions, and so I'd feed it some more and was enjoying it, but I didn't realize it at the time until she said, you know, when you start to think about that stuff, I want you to stop that, be willing to stop that and start praying for other people. So I'm driving down the road, the mind starts, those old familiar feelings are back that I'm kind of enjoying in a twisted way, and I'm like, oh, I must turn my thoughts. And I start to turn my thoughts, and I notice the resistance within me to do that. That I was kind of enjoying my victimhood and those bad feelings and thinking about it. So anyway, that is me right there. And the worse matters get in my life. And the victor continues. They continue to win. Because I am stuck. I'm still upset. I am not free. So I have squandered a lot of time in resentment. A lot of time. Thinking about what has happened, holed up in my house, isolating, watching TV, refusing to answer the phone. That's squandering. And I've done a lot of squandering. I identify with that totally. And it's telling me that it's going to kill me. And I know that that's true because I've been brought to that in sobriety where I just wanted to die. And I've been squandering hours that might have been worthwhile. Not only with those individuals, but just in living. I have a brother who is one of us, I believe. And that man can hold a grudge like nobody's business. He's like an untreated alcoholic. Well, he is an untreated alcoholic. Not like one, he is. But he can hold a grudge. He didn't speak to me for almost 5 years on one grudge. Because I wasn't treating him right, which I wasn't, but that's besides the point. I like to push his buttons. But I mean, he holds a grudge and wouldn't come to family vacations because I was going to be there. You know, and I had gone and tried to make amends and clean it up. And when I say I pushed his buttons, it was no great harm or sin or whatever. But for him, you know, it's what we do. I'm going to punish you. I'm going to keep you out here. And I'm absolutely justified in my anger towards you. I relate to that. So, when it talks about the business, when it gives the example of the business that takes no regular inventory, I mean, that was painted out for me pretty easily, that the business will fail. So how it was explained to me that made sense to me was like if my internal life is like a grocery store and I've got stuff on the shelves that are rotten, that are nasty, that are moldy. I can't fool myself about that value of that moldy bread or that rotten orange. Well, I don't want to get rid of it. I paid good money for that. I got to resell that somewhere. You know what I mean? That's my stock and trade with the world, with you. You know, but that it colors everything that I do. I was talking to Susan and Wade yesterday. I was doing a little 10th step with them. Someone said something to me, and I got fearful, or I had a fear there. So everything that I heard that person say went through that filter of my fear. And it wasn't even what they meant, but because of my own fear, that's how I heard it. Because that fear is a rotten apple on the shelf. It was coloring my stock and trade with that person. So it's like, you know, let's get rid of the moldy bread and the rotten fruit and vegetables. Let's get rid of that so people will want to come shop at your store. You know? People will want to be with you. There's also, you know, I went through a phase in AA where I was like, you know, hyper-focused on the big book and I was constantly writing inventory, and because I was so obsessed with myself and making myself perfect, and you know, getting rid of all character defects, and I wasn't whatever. Anyway, I'll talk about that later. But my sponsor said to me, you know, Valerie, at some point you're going to have to open up for business. You can't stay in inventory for forever. I mean, I became so self-obsessed. If you looked at me the wrong way, I'm like doing four-column inventory. It was crazy. I was just became obsessed for a good reason, you know. But anyway, to look at my inventory as a fact-finding and fact-facing opportunity, and to not be afraid of what I was going to find. And I tell you, when I start to write, I start to get afraid of what I'm finding. That's why I want to start editing. And I want to start managing the truth. And like, you know, Bob talks about, there can also be that fear of, oh, shit, I'm going to have to go make amends for this crap. I'm going to have to go clean this up. I'm not telling everything. But I tell you, if I don't pay the price then, I'm going to pay it later. It's like if I don't learn the lesson that's in front of me, I have had it revisited and the price was even higher. It's like, learn what, I tell one of my sponsors all the time, learn what you got to learn here so you don't have to do this again. You know, don't be afraid of all that darkness. I mean, you're standing in the light anyway when you go look at it. Because we have been, when we take that third step, we have been given the power to face this stuff and to be rid of it. And some of it is really, really ugly. It really is. So I have a long list of people that had harmed me. I had bought a couple institutions, and I had some principles that I resented. Some of the principles I resented was I actually resented the principle of rigorous honesty, because I really wanted to be able to reserve the right to lie. And so I resented that. If I didn't get perfectly honest, that's how I took that. If I didn't get perfectly honest, then I wasn't going to get this spiritual crap and I'm going to be miserable and die. So principles, and some people look at principles as your current beliefs or ideas that drive you or that you live by. But anyway, so getting that stuff down, and I had to be really short and to the point about why I was upset. I had to go look at the parts of self that were hurt, threatened, or interfered with and write that stuff down. And do like what the book talks about, start praying. When I go into inventory, you are always more wrong than I am, without exception. I'm the injured party. But I had the same experience that Bob talked about, and that everybody that I know that writes thorough inventory and is willing to be changed, we start to experience something different when we start to write fourth column. I started, when I did it for the first time, honestly, I started to experience forgiveness for people. And understanding that I am capable of the exact same thing. And not only have I done the same thing in a lot of cases, but even worse. But I'm angry at this person because they did it to me. And that was the truth. So I started to experience that forgiveness, but also just a leveling of that pride and ego, that idea that I am different from you, and that I'm, all that in a bag of chips. I started to see the truth of what I'm really capable of doing. Because I'm a master at this is what I want you to see, but the truth of who I really am, I'm going to keep hidden. And that kind of idea started to die, and that lie started to die when I started writing honest inventory and not editing or changing the truth, managing the truth, being willing to write it down. It was life-changing for me. And it does set you free. And to tell you a funny story, I mean, when Bob was talking about my part, I was talking to my sponsor and I was getting ready to talk about, we got to the fourth column and I said to my sponsor, this is my part. And I got jerked up really quickly. And where in our big book does it say my part? And I'm like, I don't know. It's in there. It's got to be in there. It's not in there, But I heard it in meetings all the time. This is my part, my part, my part, my part. And he said to me, as long as other people have a part, you will never get free. Now, with some of the resentments that I had on my inventory, I didn't see how that was possible anyway. Because I was young and innocent. And what they did was wrong. And I didn't make them do that. There's nothing I did to set that ball in motion. I was just there. With this, when I resolutely set aside, and I had to do that prayer, I need God's power to be able to look at it from an entirely different angle. To look at some of the stuff that happened when I was growing up and that I experienced. And what started to occur to me is what I had done with those experiences and how they were impacting my life today. Some of those things I used to stay a victim. And I wasn't even really bothered by it anymore, but it made for a good story if I needed your sympathy or pity. So, you know, how was I using that stuff dishonestly to justify my actions or whatever? But without that prayer and without that willingness to set aside other people entirely and just resolutely look for my own mistakes where I was wrong, it's like we were talking about, it was never about the other person anyway. I mean, they don't put their head on my pillow at night, I do. They don't put food on my table, I do. I don't want to be in bondage to that anymore, to any of it. You know, my sponsor used to say, if I resent you, you own me, and I don't want to be owned by the kind of people that piss me off. That made perfect sense to me. And I don't want to be owned by the people that piss me off. And two, for me today, if I get a resentment or I'm, you know, aware of fear or misconduct, you know, because you got a sex inventory and you got a fear inventory along with the resentment inventory, those are all opportunities for me to grow in my relationship with God. Every single one of them. They're a gift. And I would have never thought that my feeling angry, fearful, or self-centered, or anxious, or whatever, I would have never thought that was a gift. But those are the little priddings for me to look at me. And what am I doing here? What's my faulty either perception, expectation, demand, I mean, whatever, where am I wrong here? Because you may or may not ever change. I mean, I can't have my happiness dependent on you. Or my own comfortability in my own skin dependent on you. So, you know, this is a great tool for us, a huge gift for us that, I mean, gives back a lot. I mean, if we don't, you know, use it, you know, to... I was looking for a different word because, you know, I was going to use a sexual reference word, so I'm not going to do it. Where I'm not totally obsessed with me. So, I think I've got to stop there. Thanks.
All right. Thanks so much for coming out this morning. We've got more this afternoon. We're going to break for a few minutes. Before we do, we're going to pass the Seventh Tradition basket. This group is self-supporting through our own contributions. We do give to the service structure and also use your contributions to help put on events like this. All right, we're going to give the home group some time to get the lunch set up, and we want to take a break for a few minutes. Get to know the people around you at your table while we have lunch. Everyone's invited for the lunch today. We're going to come back in at 12 and start with a blessing, and then we'll line up at the table. So take a break for about 10 minutes. We'll see you here at 12.